Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Wednesday, August 26th. I'm your host, Richard Benulli. We have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including a recent trilogy where he's got three books, Investing in Revolution, Mythology of Progress, and Ultra-Processed Life. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. As always, it's my pleasure to join you in a great discussion.
Yes, and the topic you have proposed for today is very interesting, and it has to do with the whether or not lowering yields and interest rates is the solution, as we constantly hear, or if it's the problem. You've written a lot about that recently, including a recent blog posting. If you wanted to begin the discussion with an elaboration on that posting.
Yeah, my basic idea that I was trying to communicate, Richard, is that rather than saving or boosting the economy or strengthening the economy, lowering interest rates to near zero and keeping them there has actually ruined the economy. And it's ruined it in sort of subtle ways. And the reasons why it's ruined is that it changed the incentives in terms of investing and speculation, and it incentivized the kind of illusory idea that we can kind of borrow our way out of debt, if you will, or borrow our way out of malinvestment. And so those ideas are absolutely counter to the fundamentals of the way the economy really works, and to the Austrian school of economics, of which you are a proponent. And so, and the reason why, in my view, the reason why the Austrian school is a powerful set of ideas is it's actually aligned with human nature. And in other words, when the incentives change, then our behaviors change. So what lowering interest rates to zero did was it incentivized speculation rather than investing. And it incentivized risk-taking because the Federal Reserve basically put in the so-called Fed put, where their unofficial policy is to jump in and intervene massively whenever the stock market starts faltering or going down. So that creates what we call moral hazard, as people playing the stock market as a casino, they can now take on far more risk and take on far more debt because they know the Fed will bail them out. That no matter what they do, no matter how much risk they take on or how much money they borrow to throw into some gamble, the Fed will save them. And so these are massive distortions that have basically broken the causal connections between cost, risk, and return. And so the net result of this is there's another powerful thing that happened that we're not really noticing, which is the Federal Reserve's policies of zero interest rates were not across the board. In other words, households didn't get 0% credit cards. the largest, wealthiest, most powerful players, you know, corporations, investment banks, financiers, they're the ones who got the near zero interest rates in unlimited amounts of money. And so they could outbid small businesses and households for housing and everything else. So what that did was it enabled them to acquire a larger share of the productive assets, by which I mean the assets that generate income. So this basically put a rocket booster under wealth inequality and income inequality. And you'll see a chart later on that shows that wealth inequality basically changed direction in 2009. As soon as the Fed instituted zero interest rate policy, wealth inequality changed from like a gradual increase to like a rocket ship higher. So all of those elements have totally distorted our economy in a way that's not sustainable. Even though we're told that that's the solution, it's actually made worse. In other words, it's now created a crisis. Yeah, thank you. Here's the chart. So, Richard, maybe you can add some background on from the Austrian school perspective why, you know, zero or near zero interest rates are so distorting and destructive.
Yeah, and this is taken from your blog post, also on your Substack. The lit fuse, low interest rates ruin the economy, August 24th. So that's where this chart, yeah, the net personal wealth, where it just begins to go through the roof, as you pointed out from the 2009 great financial crisis, as the interest rate was, yields were lowered artificially. And that has caused all of the massive distortions in the economy and in the financial markets. You mentioned it doesn't benefit Main Street. That's a big issue, because we can say a large factor of wealth and income inequality has been exacerbated by this effect of the central banks, and in particular the Federal Reserve, making available low-cost funds, especially to the financial sector versus Main Street, right? So for many years, you could go to the Federal Reserve window and borrow at 0.25% and then get a bond 10-year at 3 or 4% and make that differential for free, essentially free money to the financial sector, lever it up, pay everybody, you know, in that financial institution. But Main Street is not really benefiting. So that's exacerbated. That's contributed a lot to that. And then as far as the Austrian school, yeah, I mean, the whole idea of distortions in this financial repression of lower, you know, keeping interest rates low, yields low artificially, has caused a lot of misallocation of capital. Like, there's no ability to assess what risk is, the cost of capital, cost of risk, and it's caused a lot of misallocation of capital in industries, and even to the point of in the financial markets. Obviously, the value is in ownership of equities and hedging strategies and optimization of capital, but there's a growing significant portion of just trading, right, in terms of trading capital, large leverage based on the low interest rates, and, you know, a lot of people in that versus actually doing, you know, active work and making things, building things, you know, would become a society based on that.
That's right. The short-term gains from trading. Well, Richard, before we started recording, you made an excellent point that I'd like you to reiterate about how the cycle of expediency of relying on low interest rates and pumping money into the financial sector is like an addiction.
Yeah, it's like an addiction. It's almost like a heroin addict who needs more. And the idea is you need an incrementally higher amount or more amount to get the same effect, the same oomph. And that's what the economy has become, especially in the U.S. So, you know, essentially it's not capitalism, as you mentioned in the article. I quote, call this whatever you want, but it is not capitalism. It's a powder keg with a lit fuse. It's a rigged system of cronyism in which those running the financial system favor the wealthiest and most powerful in every way, every day.
Yeah, that's what's changed is you change the incentives and then you take away the risk factor in borrowing money and in speculating. And then you, as you say, you concentrate the these benefits in the top few. In contrast, consider this: if the policy had been to open a Fed window for every household in America, where every household could borrow $1 million at 0.25% interest, as long as they bought a treasury bill, right, paying 3%. So they would then be earning like this, you know, the 2.75% on $1 million cost-free, risk-free, and all that money would have flowed into households. But instead, those trillions flowed into the top few. And of course, this had some other negative effects. Corporations and financiers with unlimited credit lines, thanks to the Fed's intervention, the money that would never have been available from private banks because the risk would have been too high. You know, we're not going to loan you $10 billion to buy a competitor because that's just too much money. So because of this distortion, then we see how sectors have been snapped up and consolidated into monopolies or cartels, where there's one corporate brand, then they bought 10 other companies. So it looks like there's competing brands, but they're all owned by one company, right? Or you have a cartel where there's only two providers and they provide the same service at the same cost. So it's like a quasi-monopoly. So there's that distortion where the largest players were allowed to or enabled to assemble cartels and monopolies, which are also anti-capitalist because they destroy competition, which is the foundation of any market economy. And then lastly, we have to look at what happened with like housing, that, you know, if I can borrow money at 0.25% and at unlimited sums, I can outbid any homeowner trying to buy a house for their family. I can outbid them. And then I can turn that into a rental. And then that's exactly what we've seen, right? Corporations own tens of thousands of houses. And then once they own that large percentage of the marketplace, then they can jack up rents because they have the market power. So these are perverse distortions that have really ruined the economy. I think we have to recognize that this hue and cry, which we hear, as you say, every day now, just lower interest rates and that's going to fix what's broken. That's what broke the economy in the first place. So doing more of it is only going to exacerbate the economic distortions that we're facing.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And you also talk about what capitalism really is in terms of a system of discipline and accountability in which capital is put at risk to earn a gain. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. And so when we think about capitalism in the sort of traditional way, when you go, okay, if someone has capital, let's say they have savings and they want to loan it to somebody to earn an interest on that, they're going to be very keenly interested in how much risk the borrower is facing. In other words, what are they going to use this money for? Are they going to be able to pay it back? And if the risk is high, then the lender is going to demand a much higher return. And we see this in when there's an open market, you know, when there's a free market, like in the world economy, if there's a country that doesn't have a lot of income and it wants to borrow money, and then the interest rate is going to be very high because the risk of default is higher. And so what the Fed has done is break that connection between risk, return, and cost of capital. And so if you can borrow money for a risky venture at near zero, then that incentivizes you to take on stupid risks, which will blow up, right? And that's exactly where we are now. We see many sectors blowing up from too much debt, you know, and that includes the AI data centers, commercial real estate, so on and so forth. So now we've piled up all this malinvestment, as you pointed out, and yet now we're afraid to take the loss because that's cold turkey for the heroin addict, right? The heroin borrower addict. If you have to take the losses, then of course you're going to have a very serious recession because those losses have to be taken And that's going to hurt the economy and the people who are going to lose that money. But if you don't go cold turkey, then you expire from your addiction. So it's like you take one path or the other. The end result is going to be the same. We're going to have a Great Depression, whether we keep trying to, you know, increase our heroin dose of borrowing, or if we just go cold turkey. But at least if you go cold turkey, you're going to be healthy after that terrible process is over. Whereas if you just keep borrowing money and incentivizing malinvestment and wealth inequality, you're going to end up with an economy that's really in ruins.
Another quote that you have in there is very interesting. You say the elimination of discipline, trade-offs, accountability, and risk is the infantilization of the economy. We're like children at play, free of the burdens of adulthood, because mommy and daddy Fed will make it all better.
Yeah, I really think that's true. That by taking away accountability and cost of capital, then the Fed is kind of like the helicopter parent that comes in, and when Junior is caught shoplifting, then they run in with their high-powered attorney and bail him out, or something like that. And so the Fed's going to bail out the most egregious gamblers, then why would anybody bother saving money and being prudent? Because you're losing ground to the gamblers. And so this is like, it's like letting children play with sticks of dynamite, but then rushing in to, you know, stop the fuse from reaching the dynamite. And so they think it's safe to play with dynamite because mommy and daddy will come in and snuff the fuse just before it blows up. That's kind of the story of the economy. And so as children, it's all fun and games until the dynamite blows up. And that's what we're guaranteeing, sadly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it speaks to this sort of famous quote diagram where we seem to be in this lower left portion where we've had a lot of good times, but it's created weak men and women. And now that will likely create hard times in this lower left portion here. So it's sort of a cycle of human nature.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we should speak directly to the idea of centralization as one of the flaws, that giving all this power to a central bank, to where the whole economy is now dependent on what the Fed does, that is a flaw of centralization itself. And so, in other words, if interest rates were set by hundreds or thousands of savings and loans and banks and who were sensitive to the possibility of losing the money, then you'd have a much more robust and like secure, if you want to call it, resilient credit sector. But if you're going to give all that power to one institution, which is run by a handful of people and heavily indebted, if you will, at least ideologically, to the wealthiest and most powerful entities in the economy, then you're going to create massive distortions, no matter what their intentions are. In other words, centralization itself is a terrible distorting flaw. And this is an even deeper critique, because what we're saying is it's not just whether the Fed should raise rates or lower rates, it's whether the Fed should even exist or have that much power, that the whole economy is now dependent on this one dealer of credit.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I guess in summary, or as a solution going forth, what would be your suggested ideas? The idea of creating a high-cost capital world so that only truly productive ventures get funded and speculation becomes too costly to be funded? Would that be your solution?
That would be a more sustainable economy, to go back to a market economy. And here's the thing about a market economy. it's actually painful because losses have to be taken, and ventures fail, and then losses have to be taken, and competitors arise and take away your profit margin. I mean, this is like a market economy. It's very dynamic, and loss is part of the process, because that feedback loop between making a decision and borrowing money and investing it, if that feedback is broken, then in a way, as you said earlier, the true cost of capital and the true risk that we're taking is now obscured. So we can't really make good decisions. So it's kind of like the Fed is blindfolded everybody in the whole economy, and we're wandering around a room blindfolded, trying to make an assessment of things that we can't even see anymore because the Fed has so distorted the cost of capital and risk. And so in my view, what they've done is they've taken the risk that normally would go with a gamble or an investment, and they've eliminated that risk, right? But it's not like that risk went away. It was transferred to the whole economy. And so it's kind of like the way you look at federal debt reaching $40 trillion. Well, where is the risk of this going now? Is it going to a handful of big banks? No. Is it going to the individuals that sit on the Federal Reserve Board? No. Is it going to the president? No. It's going to the entire economy. That's the risk now, is that when the consequences of that kind of massive debt or the malinvestment that's going on, now it's going to damage everybody in the whole economy, you know? So this is where it's really unfortunate and perverse, is that by appearing to eliminate risk, you know, making moral hazard the standard policy by saying, no, we're going to come in and intervene and bail everybody out, then you've created a massive risk that's hidden until it blows up the whole economy. So I think, you could go back. One solution, of course, I don't have the power to do anything on this, but if we went back to the original idea of the Fed, which was it sits there doing nothing until there's an emergency that requires emergency funding for a few months to avoid a credit crisis that would collapse a bunch of lenders and borrowers, that would work. In other words, if it just sits there doing nothing 95% of the time and it only intervenes to provide temporary liquidity to get through a credit crisis, that would be a workable system. But you concentrate that much power, then everybody wants to be bailed out. And so I don't know that you could even say the Fed is a solution, even if we go back to the original intent. So I would say my thinking along this lines is it looks like we're due for another 1970s stagflation, where they're going to go ahead and lower interest rates the first time the economy or stock market falters. And then that's going to create inflation that's going to run away. It's going to be self-reinforcing, which is what happens when everyone sees that inflation is now embedded. Then they start demanding higher prices or higher wages. And then that, of course, feeds the cycle. And so the only way to break that is the way that Paul Volcker broke it in the early 80s, which is you have to raise interest rates to the point that borrowing basically disappears, except for the highest value ventures that can afford 15% interest. Yeah. And so that destroys all parts of the economy that depend on credit. You know, that's auto purchases, home purchases. Those get destroyed. But that's the cost of the cold turkey. You know, when the addict has to go through withdrawal, it's very painful. So that's what we as individuals and households, we should prepare for that. In other words, I don't think I want to buy a 30-year bond if I think that interest rates are going to go higher. And I think, you know, you buy a short-term bond, you know, a few months out, and that way you can kind of ride the higher inflation up. And higher inflation is not good for stocks. That's what the 70s prove, is that, and the reason why is if I can make 7 or 8% in a bond, which I think is coming, why would I take the risk of a stock market that's already gone through a bunch of turmoil? You know, why take that risk when I can get a guaranteed bond return? And so the stock market in the 70s actually lost about two-thirds to inflation. So it's very interesting to think about this as saying maybe this is our future in the next decade, which is the Dow hit 1,000 in like 1967 or whatever. And then it went into this sort of up and down thing for a decade. And then it finally got back to 1,000 around 1982 or three. Well, that sounds nice. I'm whole now, right? No, because of the high inflation, 10% inflation year after year, you lost two-thirds of your money.
In real time,
the actual inflation-adjusted Dow was 350. So you lost two-thirds of your capital.
Yeah.
So this is where, you know, the stock market sort of punditry loves to look at it like nominal value, but it's not. It's actually, you have to convert it into something else. And many people convert it into gold. Other people convert it into the cost of buying a house. I don't care what you convert it into, some basket of commodities or whatever, you're gonna get a truer picture of what happens to your capital in high inflation. So we have to kind of plan for that contingency, I think, and that so that we keep as much of our capital as we can. You know, in other words, this is that old cliche, which has a lot of wisdom in it, which is it's not the return on capital we care about, it's the return of capital. If you can just get back the same value you put in, you're already going to be a winner in this kind of climate where the addict keeps increasing the dose, but it's never enough anymore.
Yeah. Well, that's great insight and likely to happen again. So two phases, you're saying. Phase one is the high inflation, lowering interest rate yields to reduce the purchasing power of the currency, causing lots of inflation, inflating away the debt, essentially. And then a phase two, cold turkey, a la Volcker style, and then things come back to normal at that time.
Yeah, after the losses are forced and the cost of capital has been freed of financial repression, and it returns to some sort of market influenced rate, and then people can see what risk and return are, and then they can start making better decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great insight, and always enjoy your writings, blogs, and discussions here. Charles, how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work?
Yeah, come to oftwominds.com, free samples of all my work and archives, or visit me at Substack at Charles Hugh Smith.
Great. Thank you very much, Charles.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. My pleasure.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.